So happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Kirsten. Happy birthday. I've been waiting to do that for 15 minutes while we fuck around with our speakers. Happy birthday to you.
That's hilarious. Thank you. Welcome to The Writer and the Critic, a monthly podcast devoted mostly to speculative fiction books, reviews, and whatever else takes our fancy. I'm your host, Kirsten McDermott. With me via Zoom and Zencaster is your co-host, Ian Mond. How are you going, Ian?
Happy birthday to you. Da-da-da-da-da-da.
Yeah. Unless there's cake, I don't care.
Okay, so we're recording this on 31 October 2020. And we all
happy,
know what that
happy
means.
Halloween, happy Beltane, yes, people yes, in the Southern Hemisphere. It still has to be Halloween.
But it is your birthday is the point I'm trying to make here.
But it is my birthday, yes, it is. And it is a weird birthday.
Why? We're both out of lockdown.
Yeah, but it's still this horrible year. Because also, like, don't forget, what is the day today?
It's a Saturday.
It's a Saturday. Like, it's not often that my birthday, which is, you know, on secularly on Halloween,
yes,
falls on a Saturday.
Yes. What point?
And this year was going to be, we were going to have a big Halloween party because it's a Saturday night, and we have a big Halloween party, decorate because we have a garage full of decorations, and have a massive, huge Kirsten birthday Halloween extravaganza. And we could because it was Saturday. It was perfect. And
Oh, yeah, that is sad.
It's going to be years till I get another Saturday.
So, oh, my God. Okay, yeah, fair enough. I had my birthday in lockdown, thank you very much. So at least you can theoretically go out today. And
I can and I am, so.
Yeah, so I'm going to not feel too sorry for you if you don't mind.
Harsh.
So I should say the situation here in Australia, or at least in Melbourne, or at least in Victoria, any one of those places, is that, yeah, Melbourne just left lockdown 3 or 4 days ago, but Kirsten's been out of lockdown for a period. I can't remember how long.
Yeah, for a few weeks. But, you know, there's still restrictions everywhere, and Melbourne and regional Victoria are still separated for a little bit longer. Yeah. So I can't come to Melbourne for my birthday.
No, but it's a ghost. No, actually it's not. Traffic volumes, it went up to 80%.
I did, and I see look, one of the first signs of normalcy surely is a truck getting stuck under the Montague Street Bridge, and that happened the other day.
Yes, my favourite bridge.
So, yay.
Yes. Yeah, if no one outside of Victoria is going to get that. So why don't you do a link to the – because there's, I think, a page dedicated to the Montague Street Bridge. And how many times it's hit.
Oh, that's brilliant. It's for those of you who don't know, a little bit of context, it's a bridge that wouldn't otherwise be any kind of a special bridge.
Well, it's a rail bridge, so that's number one.
It's a rail bridge. But it's just a little bit shorter than apparently a lot of truck drivers think it is. So trucks regularly get kind of wedged under the bridge, and it's that old joke about, you know, I guess, do they let the air out of the tyres? Is that how they get them free?
It's very hard.
Anyway, and that just happened. So it was kind of like, you know, it was like the first daffodil that heralds spring or something. It was like, yay, a truck is stuck under the Montague Street Bridge. Things are getting back to normal.
and
not enough COVID.
Yeah, well, no, but I do want to say that, you know, for our international listeners, I understand that certain parts of Europe are now going into full lockdown. So, you know, our hearts are with you. And at least the two of us fully appreciate what you're going through,
It is hard, and stay connected with everyone as much as you can. But the other thing is, because that's what everyone says, right? Stay connected, and social media and Zoom chats and all that stuff. And yes, this has been an iconic year of Zoom. But also, if you don't feel like it, it's okay. Like, if you feel like just burrowing up for a few days or whatever, and if you're one of those people who's actually kind of half guiltily enjoying this social isolation sometimes, that's fine too. Whatever gets you through it, it's going to be really tough, guys.
Now we're done with the COVID.
Yeah,
with our monthly COVID update.
This is like this little record of this year, you know. These little updates at the beginning. Maybe that's what we should change our opening to. The Writer and the Critic is a monthly podcast devoted mostly to speculative fiction books reviews, but also COVID updates.
Yeah. Yeah, let's not do that. Okay, what are we talking about?
So we are talking about two collections today, both of which are, well, yeah, dark speculative fiction slash horror slash gothic, and they're both quite good. I really enjoyed reading them.
That's spoilers.
It's a very general spoiler. So they are Growing Things and Other Stories by Paul Tremblay and Let's Play White by Chester Burke. And I think we're going to talk about the Tremblay first.
Yes, we are, because you set up the thing, the list.
Just randomly chose them, to be honest. Yeah. I think that's the order they were on the last running sheet, so I just pulled them up.
Well, that's the order I read them too. So,
as well. Yeah.
Did you mention they're both short story collections?
They're both short story collections. It's Paul Tremblay's third short story collection, I believe, and I think it was Chester Burke's first collection.
Yes, so
Remains her only collection to date.
Yes, and I believe she's written one novel as well. But we can talk about Chester more when we speak about her book. So let's start with Paul's book, Growing Things and Other Stories. I'll give the little blurb that I've got here. For some reason, I can't get into Goodreads, but that's all right. A chilling story collection by the Bram Stoker Award winner author, including stories set in the world of A Head Full of Ghosts and Disappearance at Devil's Rock. I got the Head Full of Ghosts story. What was the Disappearance at Devil's Rock one?
I've not read that book.
I have read it, and that didn't
okay, you're in a better position to tell me.
Yeah, okay, I missed that. Oh, well, anyway, moving right along. Anyway, a thrilling new collection from the award-winning author A Head Full of Ghosts and The Cabin at the End of the World, bringing his short stories to the UK for the first time. So clearly I'm reading the blurb from the UK edition. I didn't check this. But unearthed 19 tales of suspense and literary horror, including a new story from the world of A Head Full of Ghosts that offer a terrifying glimpse into Tremblay's fantastic, fertile imagination. See a school class haunted by a life-changing video, the forces at work on four men fleeing the pawn shop they robbed at gunpoint, the meth addict kidnapping her daughter as the town is terrorised by a giant monster, or the woman facing all the ghosts who scare her most in a choose-your-own-adventure. Intricate, humane, ingenious and chilling, embrace the growing things. You know what I find odd about that? It didn't actually describe the title story. I do wonder. I mean, obviously, there's 19 stories. And look, Paul may have written this blurb. But how did they choose which ones?
I don't know. I don't even know that it's necessary to.
For example, they could have said, the one with the dog walkers that gets real freaky.
They could have. I'm not sure that would have been a very good blurb. Don't write blurbs. Stick to reviews.
Yeah, thanks. So I have read A Head Full of Ghosts, but we did it for this podcast about 400 years ago.
That is the only Tremblay novel I've read. I've got the other two sitting there. I just haven't.
I have read Disappearance.
No, I tell a lie. I think I've only got Cabin at the End of the Woods.
Okay, well, I've read Disappearance at Devil's Rock, which I really liked. Very, very much in the same mould as Head Full of Ghosts in that, and in fact, he takes the piss out of this in that dog walker story, that it is very much ambiguous as to what's supernatural and what's not, if anything is at all. And then there's The Cabin at the End of the World, which everyone loved, but I didn't love as much.
Oh, no, that's the one I'm really looking forward to.
Everyone loved it. Maybe I just got up on the wrong side of bed because it has, but I think it won. Did it win a Stoker or got nominated? It did very well. So I think I'm on a minority. I did review it for Locus. I'm actually just checking because I can't remember what I wrote.
Just to remember whether you liked it or not.
So I think it I don't really want to spoil it for you, but
no, don't. Because I do want to read them both.
Okay. Let's just say, without getting into any real spoilers, there are theological aspects to the story that rub me up the wrong way. But they are unlikely to rub most people up the wrong way, and I think it was just a personal reaction to the story for me. But let's not start with a negative, because put The Cabin at the End of the World aside, Clearly, we both loved A Head Full of Ghosts because we said nice things about it. And the disappearance of Devil's Rock is terrific. And so is this, Growing Things and Other Stories. So is this collection. And that's all I have to say.
That's it. This is going to be very short.
It is, very.
I enjoyed it. I found it a little uneven. There were some stories I really loved and some that were really clever, and others that were like, for me, just didn't work. Seemed that they were, because he does a lot of experimentation with form, which I love. And sometimes it felt with some of those stories, the form overrid, I guess, the story. And it felt for me like, yes, it was clever and interesting, but I didn't really feel much of an emotional punch from the story itself. So sometimes I think form overrid that.
I got that feeling from the Choose Your Own Adventure one. It did very little.
Yeah, that was one of the ones. I went, look, it's neat. I like the idea of it. I've read fiction which uses that form, and I've read some excellent fiction which really uses that form well and plays with the mechanics of the Choose Your Own Adventure things. TM, by the way, apparently. But yeah, this story felt more like I'm playing around with the form, but not actually utilizing it all that well. You know, by contrast, the story, and oh gosh, I'm just going to quickly look at the TOC because I'm, you know me. That's so funny because in my head I was thinking Something About Birds, which is the actual title of the story, is magnificent. For me, that's the best one in the collection. It is so good, and he uses a really interesting, clever devices and metafictional techniques, but he also tells this amazingly...
It's funny because when I say a chilling story collection, that is the story that is genuinely chilling.
Such a good story. It is... Like, there's some really good stories in this collection. That one is a standout. And I think
the imagery when he goes, and it's a spoiler, sorry, but when he goes into the shop with the bird's head, and it's just it's just bizarre. And actually, and that's when I think he's at his best, when he's sort of in that Peter Straub mode where the stories are just a bit bizarre, a bit weird. See, I really like the 13 Temple one, which is the sequel to A Head Full of Ghosts, the 13th Temple, because it is a bit weird and strange, and what the fuck is going on, and why, what? But and you know, and with the knowledge as well, you're not really going to resolve this, are you, Paul? This is just
she's the narrator Mary is presenting a cipher, you know. Yes. Here's what happened, but I'm not going to tell you what happened. I'm going to tell you what happened in the guise of an allegory or something.
Oh,
like that.
Oh yeah, but a pretty fucked up allegory, which is great. And I love that. That sort of that gave me that sort of Peter Straub type feel. But yeah, going back to the bird one, love the bird one.
It's magnificent. And I think Tremblay is at his best when he brings in some really interesting techniques. And plays, because he plays a lot with the metafictional in like most of the work, a lot of the work that I've read of his, but especially in this collection, obviously. So you can see that his interest in that aspect of writing goes across his body of work, really. And he's at his best when he's melding those techniques and those craft elements with a story that's still really heightened and emotional. And he doesn't always get there. As I said, sometimes I think the craft and you know, the playing with the techniques and so on, which, you know, are done quite well, the story itself can suffer at the hands of that. But when he does it well, which he has in Something About Birds, it's just magnificent. And that story is amazing. It's so good.
So, look, my favourite story, and it's not going to be a surprise, maybe it will be, is the Dog Walkers one. I'm sorry, but it is. I don't get it.
I read some reviews afterwards and everyone is talking about how great, and I'm sorry.
I knew we were going to have this discussion, and I really wasn't prepared because I had a feeling this is going to bug you.
It bugged me so much. Like, it And this is going to sound, and this is like, for me, this is the weakest story in the collection, and too long for what it accomplishes. And
I knew you were going to say this. So this is what I'm interested in.
I was like, it's going to sound terrible, but there's no other way to say it. I'll be blunt. I was borderline bored and frustrated through reading most of that, because it's like, it's too long. It doesn't need to be this long. It doesn't, the build-up doesn't need to be this slow. And this is another one, I think, where his metafictional stuff just, it overwhelms the story. And it's clever and it's snarky, but it's a really long story to accomplish what it does. And I don't know, it's not a bad story. It's just this, it's overly long for me. And there's just so much better stories in this collection that this one, which seems to be the kind of the core of it. It's like, really? I don't know. For me, you could have lifted this one out, made it a slightly smaller book, and for me, made it a better book. But I get a lot of people are going to love this story. They're going to love the connectivity between it and other works that he's done. They're going to love all that metafictional stuff and you know, the authorial Paul Tremblay, who's presented as a slash caricature slash author stand-in. And for me, that it just left me cold. That's not interesting to me.
So I've allowed you to diss the story.
Now you tell me how great it is.
So first off, it reminded me of Carmen Maria Machado's, especially Heena's 272 Views of Law and Order SVU. Have you read that? It's in her collection.
I think I have because it's in the collection.
Yeah, it's the one that's essentially an episode guide to Law and Order SVU, but is its story in itself. This reminded me of that because it's very different. But so to set it up, it's... Yep. A stand-in for Paul, it's Paul basically, needing a dog walker for his dog Holly, and he signs up, and a company takes control. And these are the emails that are left by the walkers. You know, generally they would be a one sentence email of Holly was great. She crapped and she pissed, whatever.
Pooed and peed.
Pooed and peed. Yeah, that's it.
I did like the little continuing notation of pooped and peed on every night. That was
and
nice.
So this takes that, and then you know, the what if is, what if the people walking your dog are a tad crazy, and all three are weird in their own way, but one takes the the crown of strangeness. But what I love, I do think it needs to be this long, because what it's doing is constantly shifting the ground in terms of what it's getting to a point where you know that the character Paul Tremblay would have, this any normal person would have said to this company, stop already, this is crazy, stop with the emails, but it keeps going. And so you get into this position where it's just this delicious form of weirdness that we're all in on the joke, because clearly that's what's going on here. You don't buy that this is a genuine tension-filled story. And the rants from that from KB, I think it is, who's
KB,
one of the KB, I actually really enjoyed as rants. Yes, I can see, it's long. It's 50 pages long in my book, and it's very small type. So it's by far the longest. It's really small type, but it's by far the longest story. But those rants, especially as they get into the very nature of writing, you know, how strong Tremblay's own work. Yeah, there are nice little hints to his other books, which is fine. That's not the strength, though. It's more just the weirdness and the strangeness with this discourse on writing, on creativity, on what it is to be a creator. And I've found it bizarre and wonderful. And, yes, it needs to be that long. You need to be a bit bored with it, but at the same time, what the fuck? What was going on here? Why? What? I think that's part of the experience. I don't know. It was like a car accident where I couldn't look away. That's how it read to me at times.
Yeah, no, that's a fair enough comment. I think
I don't feel you convinced.
Well, I think maybe, and I'm not saying I have a different way to end the story, because I don't, but I think maybe, like, the longer a work is, whether it's a novelette or a full-length novel or something, right, the more time and, I guess, emotional attachment someone invests in a piece of work, you know, the more rewarding the ending needs to be, right? And for this one, and again, I guess spoilers, people, sorry, you know, the ending simply being this particular potentially psychotic dog walker saying, all right, I'm going away now, but I'll be back and I'll get you and I'll get your little dog too. It's like, oh, okay. I guess I was, yeah, it felt a bit tailed off, too, if you pardon the pun there. And I guess after that kind of a length and that kind of investment of keeping on reading and, okay, where's it going, to just have it tail off like that, I don't know. For me, it, as I said, it's not a terrible story, and there are parts in it which is – there's lots of funny, amusing things all the way through. I don't know. It wasn't one that I thought resonated with me. But clearly, in this case, I'm in the minority because every review I read mentioned this particular
story. If I was reviewing this is the one that I would probably focus – and it is the longest story, but that's not the reason why. It's the one I would probably focus on the most, where there's something about birds is clearly what you would – you would spend your time speaking.
I think that story is fantastic. I think the titular story, Growing Things, is just wonderful.
Yes, it is great. And I should say Growing Things, if you note, it features Mary and Marjorie from A Head Full of Ghosts. But obviously
you don't need to know that at all.
Well, that's clearly an alternative take on them. It's not the same
Mary. Yeah, that's what I mean. Like, it is an amazing story. Like, it is an amazing story. It is really, really strong. And again, it is this creepiness and the unease that Tremblay weaves through a lot of his work. And like you mentioned tension before, and that is something he does really well. He keeps these wonderful lines of tension running through his stories. And very often you end the story and the tension is not eased. There is no, you know, there is no sort of denouement, or there is no you know, there's no relaxation there. You just leave the story still with all this tension, and it's really good, and it works really well in Growing Things, and the story that we can't name because we can't pronounce the title.
It's just a dash.
It's just a long underscore. One about the husband who goes down to a
lake. That is a fucking amazing
it's
story.
Stunning. It's stunning. There's some brilliant, brilliant masterworks in this collection.
And I love. And what about the teacher, the one with the
kids? Oh yeah.
And he. Oh my God! If you want to read a story about corrupted innocence, or you know it, this it's this you know this class of I suppose smart special kids. The teacher is all hipster and cool. But as it goes on, you know, it just becomes this dark. Oh my God, fucking fucked up.
Really?
You've got the imagery of just that of him pausing that video of the kid that's is being flung against a wall and pausing it frame by frame as the kid is slowly, you know, through Zen's paradox, is slowly making but never will make it to the wall. Is just that's an image that will last throughout the whole. Yeah. Collection, as like the one with something about birds or whatever it was.
Something
about birds. There are just these images that just boom. They are etched into your head, and that's the one for that story. It's a corker. Sorry, but I interrupted you about the previous one, the underscore one.
The underscore one, yeah, that's what we'll call it. The underscore, because again, it's this amazing. I don't know. I think, as I said, Tremblay works. Just from reading this collection, I haven't read the other two, but now I really want to. He works best when he is, you know, as he himself says in this work, in this collection, you know, he works really well as an ambiguous writer, where he's maintaining these lines of tension and you're not quite sure where things are going to fall, and sometimes they don't fall anywhere, and you've got to fill in your own impressions or your own interpretation of what's happened or what may happen. And he does that incredibly well, and he can work with very established tropes of the genre and bring them like a new type of tension, a new type of emotion in them, and that lake story with the husband and the woman who is not his wife but is his wife is just it's amazing. That's a trope, right? That it's a trope that we see in horror all the time. And this particular story handles it incredibly well and brings this new, fresh sort of tension to it. And I think it's because in that story, we're so embedded in the point of view of the the protagonist. Is it the narrator? I can't remember.
The husband?
Yeah. Is it a first-person story? I honestly can't remember. Anyway, it doesn't matter. Because we're so embedded in his point of view. I mean, I never questioned. Excellent, first person. I never questioned that. Like, for me, that story was not ambiguous. She definitely, whatever that creature was, she was not his wife. But it allows for this you know, different readings and this uncertainty, and the ground's never quite solid but beneath your feet. And that's when he's, I think, working at his absolute best. And another story I really liked was the one which could have been so pat and so tropey and cliched, the one about the writer who commits suicide at a reading.
Oh, that's a brilliant story.
But again, it's like it's things in photographs and mirrors, and you know, it's full of all the tropes of horror. But they're tropes for a reason, because when they're used well, they work.
I mean, there are at least four or five stories about the end of the world in this collection. No, but the thing is, they're all different.
Yeah.
You don't read them and go, "Oh fuck, Tremblay, get off this." You know, you've done the end of the world enough already. Seriously, find another thing. But no, it's. He finds an entry point into each of those stories that is completely different.
Yeah.
I mean, the one through the perspective of the young child.
Oh, that is amazing.
I've never seen it done that way before.
Do not feed the ducks, or it's...
Yes, I will tell you that we're really good. It's against the law to feed the ducks.
Yeah, it's such a fantastic story, and it's one of those stories that puts a lie to the idea that you're... which is a fairly recent idea and an inaccurate one, that the readership of your story is based around the age range of your characters. Because here we have a story that's the point of view of a very young child all the way through, and we get nothing that's not his point of view. And yet it's only adults are going to understand that story.
It's such
an amazing story, and everything is there except the exact thing, perhaps, but you don't need to know the exact thing. You just need to know the world is ending.
I had not seen a sustained take on the end of the world done that way. Yeah, I've seen snippets. You'll read novels about apocalypses where, you know, the parts of it will be told through a child's perspective. Stephen King's done it many, but not like this in such a sustained, intense way. I mean, it's just so clever. And talking about clever, please tell me you like The Society of the Monsterhood.
Oh, yeah.
Because it is this brilliant story about revisionist history, but it has a big monster that fucking just wipes the town out, and it's funny, but it's all about, I mean, the opening, there's an explanation for the reader. I just want to read this out, because I think this actually does speak to what Tremblay really does, how smart he can be. It starts with, "You do not speak the language of our city, certainly not of our neighbourhood. You don't because you don't want to. You are as purposefully deaf as you are blind and have been so for so long that no one remembers it being any different. This isn't that kind of story." The rest of the story is this almost comical take on a swamp monster or something being in a town. That trope of the town who gives sacrifices to a creature, whatever, and that monster then having one of its issues and basically wiping out a town, but more importantly wiping out the school where the kids are. Yeah, and the tragedy behind that, which is almost elided or completely revisionized when the historians of the town look back, that's the thing that they change because they can't confront the horror of it. And it's just, you want to talk about, you know, the revisionist history around race in America, for example, and although Tremblay himself is a Canadian writer, but this story just jumped out at me right now. For the discussions we're having today, this story just spoke to them in a way that is completely bizarre and different. I'm sorry. I can't think of the good words to really express how much I love that story.
No, I love it. It's like, as I said, there are absolute masterworks in this collection. It is really good. And not every collection is going to have 100% brilliant, fantastic stories. So there are some that for me were a little bit weaker.
Yeah, look, I didn't get further questions for The Somnambulist. I just didn't. Yeah, and that's the one where he's really experimenting, and that's great. But did it affect me? Not really, but that's all right. It's ambitious. And that goes back to the choose your own adventure one. I like that he had a, you know, he's doing that. And look, I don't think it works, but it's still an interesting mode of storytelling. And yeah. I read too many collections where you just get the feel that the writer doesn't has a certain way of looking at the world, and the stories just follow that way of looking at the world, both in terms of tone and structure.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we'll segue to Chessie Burke, but her stories aren't as experimental as Tremblay's, but what's amazing about her work, spoilers, is how she's able to modulate and change the voice and the strength of the voice in each of her stories. They are each their own voice and power. As you read a lot of collections and you'll see, yep, that's the same basic setup, voice, tone. You know, you've done this before and you've done it, you're doing it again. And that's fine, it's all good. But
well, Steve, I guess Stephen King comes to mind when you say that, right?
Frankly.
I
mean, yeah, and it's comforting because we love it when Stephen's in that role. But no, King, look, not to make this about Stephen King, he has always experimented, but yeah, 90% of his output tastes and sounds like Stephen King.
Yeah, but I mean, I guess there's also like there's different ways to consider it. So there's, you know, there's experimentation with form, which is what Tremblay is doing a lot in this collection and in his work, and that's very visible and flashy. And yes, you see, oh look, he's working with the choose your own adventure format. Oh look, he's doing this metaphysical thing where he's talking about himself. Oh look, he's, you know, I mean, that's really visible and really flashy.
Kirsten, it's called autofiction, okay? Not metaphysical thing. It's called autofiction. Use the right term. Thank you.
It's a literary term. Metafictional, not metaphysical.
No, it's called. No, you said metaphysical. If you said metafictional, metaphysical, it's autofiction, okay? All right, please.
Well, metafictional is an umbrella term that talks about fiction that talks directly to the reader as being fiction. And autofiction is a subgenre of metafictional umbrella. So that we're clear.
Yeah, but anyway, you're probably right. You're probably right.
But what I'm saying is that stuff is really visible and flashy and everyone goes, oh, look, that's new and interesting and different. But there's different ways of experimenting in fiction, and sometimes you are experimenting with content and you're experimenting with point of view and perspective. So it's I think it's a bit, yeah, it can be dangerous to sort of say, oh, well, this is experimental because we see it and it's flashy and this isn't. This is much more traditional storytelling when it actually isn't, because it is telling different stories and using different perspectives. But we just don't see it as...
No, but as I said, and this is a good segue now because I think we can segue into the next book. So... Chessie Burke stuff isn't outwardly experimental. There's one story, the one Q has a bit, you know, a bit to it, but it's that I'm not saying that that's it's what the author the way the author approaches the story. And in the case of Burke, it's this voice is so important to each of the stories, and the change and shift and tone in the voice. It's just, you know, the different registers she uses from story to story is incredible.
Yeah.
It struck me from the first story until the last how the register does change so markedly from story to story and is pitched perfectly. I'm really getting into the music metaphor stuff. pitched perfectly for each piece. You can tell I've been writing reviews for Locust recently. I'm using all the big daddy critic words. Anyway, keep going. Let's go on to that one. Let's Play White by Chessie Burke.
Yeah.
Now that I've said my thoughts, Kirsten.
I'll read the blurb, which is sitting on Goodreads there. White brings with it dreams of respect, of wealth, of simply being treated as a human being. It's the one thing Walter will never be. But what if he could play White the way so many others seem to do? Would it bring him privilege or simply deny the pain? The title story in this collection asks those questions, then moves on to challenge notions of race, privilege, personal choice, and even life and death with equal vigour. From the spectrum spanning despair and hope in What She Saw When They Flew Away to the stark weave of personal struggles in Chocolate Park, Let's Play White speaks with the voices of the overlooked and unheard. I Make People Do Bad Things shines a metaphysical light on Harlem's most notorious historical madam, and then with a deft twist into melancholic humour, Q Change brings a zombie-esque apocalypse, possibly for the betterment of all mankind. Well, that's the whole blurb. That's abrupt. and also interesting in terms of the stories they're picking out, didn't mention the final novella in the collection, which is, oh, my God, amazing.
Yeah, oh yeah, yes. The Teachings and Redemption of Ms. Fanny Lou Mason. Yes, it's terrific. Loved it.
The whole collection is good. To lead up to this final novella, it's just brilliant. I read the novella in one sitting without even noticing how long it was. It was just, you just sink into that story, and it is terrifying and creepy and just beautiful. It is a wonderful, wonderful story.
There's a childbirth, there's two, there might be more, childbirth scenes that they're going to stick with me.
Right.
There's the world. Just, yeah, anyway, but, you know, that is an incredible piece of writing. But it starts with a story called Walter and the Three-Legged Kind, which is where the title comes from. The
title of the collection, yeah. It's not the title of the story, but it's a line of dialogue from the story.
Correct. Come on, please tell me you read it and you thought immediately of Michigan J. Frog.
I did not.
Do you know who Michigan J. Frog is?
I do not.
The singing frog from Warner Brothers.
Okay.
You know the one with, you know, where the guy has this singing frog, and it only sings for him, and it won't sing for anyone else. And when he opens it, yeah. And so in this story,
he's got the talking rat.
He's got the talking rat, and I know it doesn't sing, but it just feels, for some reason, it brought in my head this Warner Brothers singing frog, which is not really the point of the story. But
I don't think so.
No, but it does set the tone for what the collection is about, which is, as actually I think the blurb says really well, it is about the people on the outside, the marginalised, the ones who are forgotten or ignored or et cetera. And it is, it's a collection really about living. And, look, it is a collection. Well, here's the thing, Kirsten.
What's the thing?
Okay, so I have to be very careful here. So it's a collection written by a person of colour dealing with issues of race, and it's fantastic in doing that. And I'm not sure what my point is, but we're comparing it to a book from a white author, and what I find is when we talk about works from people of colour and own voices type work, it's very much about their cultural, their identity, etc. And yet when we seem to talk about people like Paul Tremblay, just picking him because that's the book we looked at, it's about just the stories themselves. And I don't know, does that make you feel uncomfortable, or is it just me? That
I think it's something that it makes you...
Did I express that right? Because I know it sounds vaguely racist. But it's
no, you did express it. And I think, look, if Growing Things is a very white book, right? And it is a cultural book, you know. And a lot of what Paul Tremblay is talking about in a lot of the stories is a particular culture, but it's one that is invisible, right? Because it's the dominant culture, you know. It's the white middle class culture, and it's the concerns of that culture and the things that culture thinks about. And it's really interesting to look at the Tremblay collection with, as you pointed out, three or four apocalypse or post-apocalypse stories, and to think about how they're played out in what we would probably consider a very traditional way, you know, apocalypse bad and, you know, people fighting against it good, et cetera, et cetera. And the apocalypse story, which is a huge change,
quasi-zombie one
story,
yeah,
in the Burke collection,
yeah,
entangles that narrative beautifully. And makes you question if the, you know, Burke's particular apocalypse and the way she signifies it and codes it, would it be that bad? Like, would it actually be that bad to be this type of a zombie? Zombies which seem to be more compassionate than their human counterparts, which seem to be more collaborative and cooperative and self-sacrificial. Would it be that bad? You know, it is quite interesting to see a different, and I haven't quite seen whenever I see a apocalyptic type narratives treated in a more positive light, it's more the case of wiping the slate clean and all that kind of bullshit, right? Because, you know, when we talk about wiping the slate clean and starting over, we're talking about the deaths of billions of people that we don't care about. Whereas this kind of positive take on an apocalypse is really interesting. I loved that story. I thought Q Change was really, and it made me, and I still don't know how I feel about it. Like, I don't, because I've still got this instinctive reaction of, well, no, of course that's not good. Of course it's better to be you and an individual and everything. And yet, is it? We haven't done a great job.
Yeah, no, and it's interesting you bring that story up, because I just, to go back to the Tremblay comparison, it's not that he doesn't deal with the working class or poverty. There is, I mean, there's a story that's described on the back about, which we didn't discuss, about a meth addict, and there are a couple of stories that play in the in that working class space. But it is very much, and this is not an attack, but it is very, as you said, it is very much a very white book and a white middle class book.
Yeah.
It really is. That's what it is. And for us, well, for me in particular, and I won't speak for you, Kirsten, but for me, I am well and truly probably white middle class, probably upper middle class in some instances. So the Tremblay just fits the narrative. And I'm Jewish as well, so I have a bit of that persecution side. You know, but, well, it's true. I mean, but yeah, absolutely. It is Tremblay's work just fits that narrative for me. It just, you know, when I read that story about that young kid seeing the apocalypse through his parents' eyes, I loved it, and I see it through my children's eyes, and I see it through my circumstances, my current circumstances.
Yeah.
When I read Chesia Burke's collection, it is a completely different situation. It is very much about the underprivileged and the marginalised, etc. And it takes me well and truly, each one of those stories, to one extent or another, takes me well and truly out of my comfort zone. It does. And that's why the voice is so important, and why it, you know, it just resonates. But I can't say that. Look, that's the joy of reading a collection like this. But you sort of, I sort of say that. And I hear myself saying it right now, and it sounds oddly patronising. Like, well done that you've taken me out of the comfort zone. Well done that you've taken.
I think, and I don't know how to.
And I struggle with that, because it does. It sounds patronising.
Yeah, but I think what you can do with that is flip the patronisation. So rather than say, well done, Chesia Burke, like, well done, Ian, for reading another book. Like, there's a different book. Well done, Ian, for taking yourself out of your comfort zone. Which is patronising, but well done, Ian. To be fair, I think when we talk about own voices and not necessarily, you know, every single book, because it is tedious to read a book outside of the dominant culture and constantly be referring to the fact that it's outside of the culture.
Yes, but that's it. Tedious. That's it. Thank you. Keep going, please.
But certainly, yes. Chesia Burke's collection explicitly talks about this subject matter. So to not address it and to not refer to it would take a chunk out of the heart of this book, right? She's not just a person of color writing a collection of horror stories that would be interchangeable with a Paul Tremblay collection or a Caitlin Kiernan collection or any other collection you want to see. She is addressing certain issues, right, around race, around privilege, and not just racial privilege, but like the different intersections of privilege and bias and you know, inequality. And so to excise that and to not talk about it would be ridiculous, because the book itself makes it front and center in almost every story. Like, the stories are talking about poverty and race and inequality and inequity. So they're talking about other things too. They're really good horror stories, but they are that is a major theme. So you have to acknowledge it and talk about it. And a lot of own voices books do, they're not the only thing it's about, but they do center that. And quite rightly, because for a couple of centuries, we haven't been thinking about those perspectives and we haven't been publishing those perspectives. So for right now, and maybe for a few decades yet, it is going to be front and center of a lot of this writing from people outside of the dominant culture. So on one hand, yes, it does feel like, oh, you know, we're talking about this as a story from a black author or a story from an Asian author or a story from a queer author, as opposed to just an author. But at the same time, right now, hopefully not for too much longer, but for right now, that's really important.
Yeah, no, I understand. And look, I don't want to make this all about me. I keep doing that.
Not, but well done, Ian.
No, thank you. I know. I made it all about me. Look, and we should point out
this
collection.
Let's talk about it. Like, the other side of that, let's talk about this as a really fucking good horror collection.
Yeah. And look.
And we talked about how Tremblay did ambiguity really well. So does Burke. Like, a lot of her stories, like, I don't know if they're supernatural or not. And I like not knowing. The one about it's heartbreaking. It's also a birds one. What she saw when they flew away, about the mother who comes home and she a daughter of her, one of her daughters has died and the other daughter is struggling a lot. And the birds.
And there's the bird, and there's birds caught in the walls. Yeah.
And you don't quite know what that story, like that story doesn't land anywhere specific. And I didn't want it to. I like the fact that it, like, the meaning of that story, the explicit meaning, if there is one, flies away with the birds as well, and you're left just watching them. I think it's a fantastic story. I love that one so much. But yeah, there's not really a dud story in this collection. It is
they are all extraordinary. Yeah. I mean, and yes, a story like The Unremembered.
Which one was that?
So that's the one about the young girl. Her mother is she's always in pain. She hasn't spoken for 12 years.
Oh.
She's, you know, ill, and she's now remembering the African cultures, I believe, of hundreds of years past. But what's the kicker of that is as she starts remembering, or starts being because she starts bleeding as well, and so this he's not a priest, he's a father, whatever. Sorry.
Yeah, no, I know what you mean. And like the quasi-stigmata thing, which is what?
Yeah, so she starts, having stigmata, or showing stigmata, signs of stigmata. And so a priest or father, some Christian guy, comes in and, you know, he's and immediately perceives it as being something Christian. But it's not. And the takedown at the end of this story to that father/priest is just a punch in the face. It's brilliant. In fact, what I've just done for 10 minutes about it's not all about you, Ian, it's not all about your religion, mate. There are other faiths, yeah, other beliefs, and all you've done is come in and colonize them. And then you're trying to do it again. It's extraordinary.
That was the one story, I think, where, and I still am slightly uncomfortable with it, just because it does, and I still don't know. I'm thinking about that story a lot, because it does play a lot with that, the idea of because the girl in that story is explicitly described as severely autistic, you know, that's been her diagnosis of a while, and what this story is doing is saying there's something else going on here, and it skirts very unclose, very close to being quite uncomfortable with that metaphor, because it's not quite the magical disabled person, although it's getting very close. And yeah, I don't know quite how I feel about it. It's
fair enough.
I'm very, as I said, I was uncomfortable with it for a lot of it, and I was waiting to see where it went. And it didn't end in a magical cure or anything like that, which is great. But I still don't know. I'm uncomfortable again with withdrawing that, because the story does so explicitly diagnose the child, and that's how the child has been framed by the people around her, the medical community, and so on. And it's sort of like, oh, I don't know. I don't know that I'm comfortable with the autistic child actually being, you know, a metaphysical conduit of history, or however you're going to describe it. I don't know. I don't think it's. I think it's done with a certain amount of sensitivity. But yeah, I still don't.
I can see what you're saying, that it skirts. And I hadn't. And yeah, look, I hadn't perceived it. I hadn't read it that way. And there you go. There's my biases in place. But I understand that. Mm. I think, as you say, it doesn't end with a magical cure. And in fact, I mean, look, the fact that it correlates the weight of history with autism, or with an illness or whatever, a disability of some sort. Yeah, I can see that being a bit on the nose. And
like I said, I don't, like, it's not a bad story, and I still don't quite know how I sit with it. It's the only one where I just felt really uncomfortable reading it and not sure I was with the author with what they were doing there. But I haven't made a decision about it yet because it's a really complex, well-written story, and I'd want to read it another couple of times. And I didn't have a chance to go back and reread any of these. So, but it is really interesting.
Was the novella your favourite?
I think it was, but only because I haven't reread the collection. I suspect if I reread it, some of the earlier ones I read, like What She Saw When They Flew Away is just remarkable. There's so many good stories in there. But, yes, the final novella, The Redemptions and Teachings, I'm sorry, I can't remember the whole title. Oh, my God. It's an amazing piece of work. And the way that Burke uses, you know, some misdirection at the very beginning, which I tell a lie that I didn't go back and reread that, but I went back and skimmed over a few places to because it was such a good novella. And she's really, like, Burke is so smart the way she has set up the little prologue, which is this amazing story on its own. The prologue of that novella is this beautiful, heartbreaking piece of fiction that the last line of that, you know, I didn't want my babies to see what we were going to do to you. Like, that in itself is just this wonderful, dark, creepy piece of fiction.
Well, yeah, because she's essentially saved a town.
Yeah.
But she was going to be lynched, or it looks like.
Something,
Something terrible. And the mother of some children sent her kids to, was it a chapel or et cetera? To the town hall, which ends up collapsing. And that's the whole thing. She's got them out there because she knows it's going
to
collapse.
And that's what Fanny Mae was trying to do, to get them away.
You're right. That story, you could have just taken that and just kept that as a standalone piece.
But what Burke does is she uses that as a foundation for this amazing novella, and it's sitting there. You don't even realize it's sitting there in the back of your mind for the whole way through as a template for what you think the novella is going to do.
Yeah.
And then I'm not going to spoil this one at all, but she just undermines it in the most exquisite ways. I loved it. I think that novella is absolutely magnificent, and I'm really sad I hadn't heard about this before.
You mean the collection, or you said this is the first? This is the first time you've read, because you said you weren't going to.
It is the first time I've read Chrystia Burke, and I don't understand why that novella wasn't getting World Fantasy Awards and Bram Stoker Awards all over the place.
I would say that about nearly all the stories. I mean, Chocolate Park, is another, because again, you know, you could, you know, you talk about being uncomfortable about the previous story, The Unremembered. You could argue, well, here this is just another story about women being sexually abused, drug addiction. It's especially people of color, and it's also, it has all those elements that could be gratuitous. And but it's just done with – there's such a humanity to Chocolate Park and an attempt to – because it is a sad and tragic story. It's not a happy story. But there's also this – and it runs through all her stories. There's this real thread of humanity and an attempt to understand and unpick and explore those issues without making them gratuitous or without making them torture porn or anything like that. Because there is some really dark shit that goes on in Chocolate Park. But yeah, I mean, again, I can't think of the words to express it, how much that story resonated with me. And because it doesn't try to be overly dark and harsh, but yet when people get their comeuppance in a Chrystia Burke story, you do sort of a bit cheer a little bit, even if it's a little bit. Because that does happen a few times. There's a few comeuppance elements. But, I mean, you know, like, in fact, in that story, there's – because it's broken up into five chapters. And the fourth chapter – and it's only a novelette, but it's very short. The fourth one is, I think, the couple in the apartment who are the one white couple in a black area. And that story on its own, that little section there could be its own story, how powerful that is about, a guy who's fell in love, had a child, but they're not rich. They've moved to a poorer part of the neighborhood. Just that story and what and the anger and the frustration all through his perspective, the the hatred, it's brilliantly done. I'm sorry, it's brilliantly done.
No, it really is. I think what one of Burke's strengths, and it's when Tremblay does this well, he's writing in his best, but Burke does it all the way through. She just does amazing character work. All of her stories, the narratives themselves, like the plot lines or whatever you want to call them, you know, they're well wrought and complex and everything, but her stories rest on her character work.
Like Queenie.
Amazing.
I mean, Queenie is the main the character that just keeps coming back to me, the one who runs the numbers.
Who's based on a real a real personage in Harlem.
You went and did research, didn't you?
It's funny because I had a vague, like not a memory, but like it was vaguely familiar. And I actually, because I remembered listening to a podcast about like the numbers and that whole system and how it arose and everything. I didn't remember her, but then I went and did, just a very slight bit of research. I was like, oh, she was based on a real person. Awesome. Because I wasn't sure whether Chesia Burke had put a fictional character into a real situation or what she'd done. But she's, I mean, like there's still a lot of fiction in that story, we hope. but yeah, no, that's another great. But this is what she does. She her character work is rich and complex, and it's tied in with what you were talking about, the different and authentic voices for each of the story. Whatever the characters or the narrator in that story needs, that's the voice that Burke will write for it. And that's part of it. Like her character work is just absolutely amazing. All of her characters, whether they were walk-ons or not, or whether they're in like a vignette as part of a bigger story, they all feel like real people who are complex and deep and don't just have, you know, one-dimensional motives or anything like that. Like it's just even the villain in Chocolate Park, he's not one-dimensional. He's rendered with more complexity. He's still villainous and evil, but he's very like he's rendered in a very complex way with that, and she does this so deftly and so beautifully, and I loved reading all of these stories because it really was like meeting all these different people, and she does this wonderful thing in most of the stories, especially where she has the time to do it, where she will slightly, not completely reverse who you think a person is, but add these extra layers or add this adjunct to their what you think you know about them that manages to cast them in a different way or makes you think about them in a different way. And she does that, you know, best because she has the room to play with it, I think, in the final novella. But she does it all the way through the collection, including the very first story, which I can't remember the name of it now, but I just think of it as Let's Play White now, which is not its title. It's Walter and the Three...
Walter and the Three King.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It starts off as this very sort of slice of life story about, you know, a person who's you know, down on his luck and underprivileged and living in...
He's unemployed.
And can't get work, and there's racial elements, and there's a rat that... Maybe is you know, he might be imagining the rat or whatever, and there might be rats. And there's that horrible scene where Walter pulls the leg off the poor rat, which just made me, I was just thinking, I can't do a whole book of this, please.
Rat torture. I can't do a whole book of rat torture.
A whole book of, please don't let this be the book. And then the rat comes back and just starts to talk. I mean, what the fuck is that?
And
she just twists this whole story 180, but it all makes sense. Like it's just I think it's a perfect story to open the book because it has a lot of the themes of the book. It has this great character work, and it has these wonderful little switchbacks that Burke manages to do with her stories and her characters. It's if you read that opening story and it doesn't grab you, you might not enjoy the rest of the collection, let's face it. It's
Sorry. If you're not grabbed by that opening story, I don't know why you're listening to this podcast.
Well, that's true.
No, because the language of I do want to give a taste. So just the language of the opening paragraph of that story, which I'm now rapidly flicking to. So to me, I mean, and let's be clear, not all the stories sound like this. But they have a rhythm, their own rhythm. But this is the way she writes, and it's you said it all perfectly, so I'm not going to repeat what you said, but I just want to quote the opening paragraph. So it's reasonably long, so just bear with me. Shit droppings on the sink were always evidence that the rat had been there. Walter hated the beast. It did nothing but live off the crumbs he left. It survived. It thrived off of his misery. Day after day, he watched the thing grow fat while he wasted away. Walter wondered if he died right there on the floor, if the rat would eat his rotting corpse. That was okay. As soon as he got the chance, Walter was going to catch the thing and choke the shit out of it with his bare hands. And if that didn't work, then he would figure something out. One way or another, he would defeat that rat. And it's just, it sets the tone of the story. You know, it's, just great. And, you know, look, I don't want to talk about awards because awards aren't the be-all and end-all and probably too much significance is put on them. But this collection came out in 2011, 9 years ago. This is my first taste of Chesia Burke's work. And I'll be honest, I have owned this collection for a number of years. So I didn't have to buy this collection. I already owned it. So I was aware of Burke as a writer and I bought her book from Apex, I think, who published it, but I never read it. But I think but a lot of my reading when I'm not reviewing is guided often by what's top of mind, you know, what people are talking about.
Yeah, the buzz.
And the buzz, yeah, that's what guides me sometimes, not all the times, but a good chunk of the time. And, look, I'll be honest, from buying this collection, until you mentioned it for this podcast, I doubt I would ever have read this collection. And look, there's so many books like this. But it's a bloody tragedy. What the fuck? And I'm yelling at myself here, not at Jesse Burke. This is me. What the fuck?
I think it is. And I, to be honest, I can't remember where I came across this book. I know over the last couple of years I've been keeping a lot of lists of things and I don't remember where I came across this one, but something about whatever the review or the recommendation was, grabbed me and I put it onto my list of books to check out when I was finished the Infernal PhD. And now I have. And I'm really, really glad I came across it because that's it. I've not seen it since. It's not like it's come up again since the first time I saw it and I've thought, oh, yeah, that's a book on my list. I just, you know, I went through the list when we were thinking about books for this year and just picked out some that I thought were interesting, many by authors I hadn't read because I wanted to try some authors I hadn't read before. And this happened to be one of them, but it could have been one of another 30-odd books. So we're both just lucky that for whatever reason, twice, I just picked this one. But, yeah, it is such a strong collection. And since you read a bit from that story, I'm going to read another bit from The Teachings and Redemptions of Miss Fanny Mae, the final novella, because it's very rare. I watch a lot more horror than I read these days, but I read a lot and it's very rare for me to have that kind of frisson of terror and, you know, hair standing up on the back of your neck from something I read. I don't get it that often from stuff I watch anymore either, sadly, but it's a lot more common from a visual or oral stimuli to get that physiological sort of reaction. So a lot of, you know, even with the Paul Tremblay work, and I'm not saying it's not emotional, it doesn't get me viscerally, but it's very rare to have a physiological reaction when I'm reading. Obviously your mileage may vary, but that's me. But there's this one scene in this novella where it was like, oh my God, it was so well done. And this is, so the two girls who are twins, kind of the story ends up revolving around them and Ms. Fanny Mae becomes kind of a mentor to them. But this is just a story about them. And they're young girls and they're going to this old deserted house that's been abandoned ages ago. And there's this, it's one of the places that they go to hang out and do stuff. And the story tells you how, you know, they go there and there's this closet of shoes, like this weird old closet with old moldy shoes. And they just play a game where they pick up a shoe and they throw it up this staircase and it hits the wall and bounces back down. And I just want to read a section from this particular scene. So I'll just start in the middle of this paragraph. Each girl threw and each watched her shoe roll back down again. This was fun. If one of the shoes stopped and landed on the stairs, the other would try to hit it, knocking it back down again. However, every once in a while, the shoes would not hit the wall and come rolling back down to them, but would go over the side and into the upper deserted region of the house. And this was the really fun part. That day, Iona was the first to have her shoe miss the mark, landing in one of the back bedrooms. The two watched the shoe fly through the air, twirling, twirling, until it disappeared into the darkness. They sat there for a few seconds, waiting, watching, and as they expected, within seconds, the shoe was thrown back down to them. It's just, oh God, I got that little creepy feeling just then. And that's not even the end of the paragraph. It ends with, it flew from the top of the stairs by unseen hands and rolled back down the steps, bounding one slow stair at a time.
The bit that creeped me out was that, but then the last bit where they go, you know, because they unknot the shoelaces and they know when they come back, the shoes will be back where they were or knotted up.
Yeah, but it's something she does throughout a lot of her stories. She'll introduce the, if there is a supernatural aspect, and I don't think there is in all of them, I might be wrong, but she'll introduce that in just this sort of sideways thing where you're not expecting it at all.
Correct.
And it just shifts the story. And that scene was like, because, you know, the build up to it is just these two girls and they're going to this house, and it's not particularly creepy. They don't find it creepy.
Although at this point, you know, there's something strange about the girls themselves.
Oh, there is something strange about the girls themselves, yeah.
Yeah, and I guess you know at that point, but you don't expect there to be a haunted house situation.
No. And then the way, and again, I'm not going to spoil it, but the way Burke uses this later in the novella, everything she's put into this has two or three effects or two or three jobs it's doing in the novella, and it's just amazing. It's so good. Like I said, I don't know why it wasn't all over, you know, award nomination ballots in 2011-12, because it's an amazing novella. It is so good and so smart and so scary.
Look, for those of you who have read this already, well done, but I hope we've opened, you know, more of you will now buy this and read it as a result of this podcast.
And you know what? Also, it's a hopeful novella. Like, the collection itself is really dark and there's dark stuff that happens in here, but I think that the type of horror that Chesia Burke is writing in this collection, it's horror at its best, is kind of inherently optimistic, which sounds weird.
Yeah, no,
but I
understand.
Believe it's an inherently optimistic genre.
No. So a lot of these stories have bittersweet endings, but there is a sweet.
Yeah, and I think that's what Burke is doing. She's saying that the life, the environment, your situation, whatever can be shit. Like it can be the worst, the literal worst. But there's still something. There's something.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. And that is look. This will be my final thing. But that is probably one of the differences between the Tremblay collection and this one. Tremblay will end, and it'll end on a really dark, nihilistic note. There's no turning back. Whereas Burke stories are actually sometimes inherently darker than the ones in The Growing Things, but have that bittersweet final note. It's not that you cheer, although I did cheer a couple of times due to comeuppances related situations, but it's not that you cheer. It's just that there's that lasting flavour of hope. I think hope feels a more grandiose word than it is, but
exactly what you're saying. And, you know, just to go back to what we were talking about the cultural stuff, it's really interesting actually, because when you just said the word nihilism is kind of what I thought was, you know what? It's really only white middle class people that have the privilege of talking about nihilism.
I'll be honest, when I said that line, you just expressed what I was actually thinking when I said that line. But
you know, we get to play with that because it's not where we live. So we get to play with it and say, look how fun. And if you do live in a place in the world where your daily struggles are really intense and you've got so many intersections of underprivilege and discrimination and bias to get through every day, as a lot of her characters in this book do, you don't have time for nihilism. I mean,
and the thing is, and there's a strong argument, I've seen it said before, so it's not original to me, that the apocalypse narrative is a function of the privileged.
Oh, absolutely. Look, like I said earlier,
I love them.
One of the main attractions of, like, let's face them, one of the primary attractions of the apocalypse genre is whether it's explicitly noted by the creators or the consumers, is the idea that you're going to get to be on the blank slate, right? It's the world is fucked. Let's just start over and make it better. And we don't often unentangle what that means. But we all, none of us are going to be the zombies. We're all going to be the guys, you know, planting wheat by the fucking airport, or, you know, building the fort and keeping the bad guy. Where, you know, that's our blank slate. And it's an incredibly privileged position to think about, because you're saying you don't care about the billions of people who get to die for your little start again fantasy.
So, yeah, so Jonathan Lethem's got a new book out next, in a couple of days, called The Arrest, which is a post-apocalyptic novel, but it's one unlike you've ever read before. And and I'm not going to spoil it at all, except to point out that he does take a crack at exactly this, and particularly Cormac McCarthy, and he has a go at a bunch of Margaret Atwood and Stephen King, and one of the characters says that these authors, and look, it's not true necessarily of these authors, but it's because it's an exaggerated comment, but these authors, they write these stories because they want to live there.
No, I agree.
They want to live in these realities because this is the opportunity to not be accountable for all the shit we've done and just start anew.
It's the clean slate. It's an incredibly attractive proposition for a certain culture.
Correct. And let them get – it's a great book. So if you just on the side, The Arrest, you should read it. It's short too.
Maybe we should read that next year.
Yeah, I highly recommend it. Yeah, we should do that one next year.
Cool. Yes, that'd be good. We'll have to start thinking about next year's list, because it is. There's only one podcast to go for this year.
God, there is.
There is. Yeah. This is my elegant segue into wrapping up. So, yes, that's our books this month. Recommends from both of us for both books, I think. And next month, it's getting super exciting. So this next month we're recording at the end of November, but it will be the December podcast. So it's the last one of the year. And then I'm going to take a break. So our next one will be in February 2021. How happy are we to see the end of 2020? But next episode, we're having a special guest, because we can do that now. Yay. We've abandoned geographical restrictions. So there may or may not be more guests next year. We'll have a think about that over summer and see what we can arrange. But next month we're having a friend of the podcast back to the podcast, Lisa Hannett, who is a fantastic writer and has been on the podcast before as a guest, is coming back, and we're going to talk about Beowulf for the whole hour or more, like just Beowulf. Different iterations thereof. Basically, Lisa wanted to talk about The Mere Wife by Maria Devana Headley, which I mentioned in our very first return podcast earlier this year as a book that I'd read over the past few years that I loved. So I'm really looking forward to reading that. But we're also going to talk about Beowulf, A New Translation, which the same author has recently published. And look at those two books together. And as a bonus, I'm gonna go away and read another Beowulf contemporary translation by Seamus Heaney, who's a poet that I love. And I've had his Beowulf sitting on my shelf for a few years and haven't gotten to it. So I can mention that as well.
Yeah. So I should point out here that I'm doing exactly the same things, including the Seamus Heaney Beowulf, and that is because. My favorite podcast in the universe, because it is the greatest podcast. If people listening to this are not listening to that, I don't know if we can be friends anymore.
The name of it is?
Backlisted. I've mentioned it before, Backlisted. Their episode that went live a couple of days ago, or maybe it's about to go live, is on Beowulf.
Oh, my God. I might listen to that after I read the books.
Yes, and it's also looking at the because they're doing literally what we're doing. But we came up with the first, but then they're doing it. So this is literally synchronicity, because I didn't speak to Andy Miller or John Mitchison about what they were doing.
No, but in fact, Lisa came to us and said, "Hey, I'd really love to do this. You want to talk about Beowulf?" It's like, of course.
Because they're also looking at other iterations, including Maria Devana Headley's translation as well. So, and I think they're also reading they're also talking about The Mere Wife. So basically, our podcast can be compared to their podcast, and you can listen to them simultaneously.
Maybe not simultaneously. That might be difficult. Maybe consecutively would be better.
To be fair, though, theirs will be out before ours, so you can listen to theirs first and then see, and I promise not to cheat and listen to theirs until we've done ours.
Oh, okay. All right. Maybe I shouldn't.
Yeah, I'm going to hold it off. I am, because I knew this was happening. So I'm going to actually hold off the enjoyment I get from listening to Backlisted.
Okay.
And I am going to there's no cheating.
There's no copying each other's
words. Yeah, no copying. So people listen to both, they go, well, you just repeated everything that they said.
Fair with enough. Their guess. I will do the same. So I'm really looking forward to that. I have read The Mere Wife, obviously, a couple of years ago. That was a book when I read it, I knew I wanted to reread it. Really looking forward to doing that and seeing what Headley's done with the new translation. I've heard good things. Very keen to read it, and that's also why I'm reading the Haney, because I think it'd be interesting to look at the two different contemporary translations of it. So I'm pretty sure
that's what Haney, the people said.
We started already. Maybe we could just get their podcast and put it through a modulator so they sound different and say it's us. And then we don't have to do the work.
I do sound a lot like Andy Miller. There's no doubt about that.
Anyway, that's what we're doing. So if you want to play ahead, does that make sense? I don't even know. Play along. If you want to play along, then you can read ahead. That's a new portmanteau. If you want to play ahead, to recap, we are reading The Mere Wife and Beowulf, A New Translation, both of which are written by Maria Devana Headley and Lisa Hannett, who is an amazing speculative fiction writer in her own right. And she just has a new collection out this year, Songs for Dark Seasons, and we'll probably talk about that very briefly at the beginning, but no spoilers, I promise. Okay, that's us. That's us for this Halloween, although you listeners will be hearing it significantly after Halloween because I'm not spending my birthday editing. So you can leave feedback, as always, by commenting on the website, which is writerandcritic.podbean.com, sending an email to writerandcritic@gmail.com, following us on Twitter, where we are at writerandcritic, and Ian mainly manages the Twitter. Or, well, you're meant to. I don't know if you do. All I do is duck in and upload the podcast link. And you can sponsor us on Patreon and also leave comments on that page. And we love the patrons who've sponsored us. We appreciate the small injection of monthly funds now that we're using Zencastr, for which I would like to thank Jonathan Strahan for the recommendation. It's making our life a lot easier in geographic separation. And hopefully, this is the first one I've recorded using this interface. Hopefully, it will make my editing life a bit easier too.
And if it sounds great, thank him. If it sounds shit, blame him.
To be fair, Jonathan doesn't have anything to do with the software. It's just... he happens to use it and said, hey, try this. So yeah,
that was a really – he obviously heard my plea in one of the previous episodes. So
I was getting, as I'm sure listeners understand, I was getting particularly frustrated this year because I do like the sound of us being in the same room, which this isn't going to be, but it will be better than what we were doing before. So thank you.
Perfection on your side and me tinny on the other.
Yeah, I may not sound as good, but I can live with that if we both sound better together. And, you know, it's just going to make it easier to have people on. So we may have a think about that over summer and may have some guests in next year because that's always fun.
I want to have guests.
To see what other people are reading.
I'm carrying this podcast, so I want guests, all right? So.
Okay. You know I can edit you to make you say anything.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you.
Goodbye, everyone. So
bye. I'm going to put salt on because I'm going out. Bye.
Okay. Hopefully that all worked. I'll let you know.